What is going on, everybody? Welcome to A Theology of Hustle. This is episode 58, and I cannot wait for you to meet Jake. This episode is taking a little bit of a different track than normal. All my episodes, or most of them at least up to this point, focus on somebody's story, and we walk through a story and we see how God has shaped their work, how they use their work for God's kingdom now, and we get something out of that story. This episode is much more teaching than it is story, though. Jake has a great story. He's done amazing work, but he is releasing a book that actually comes out today. You can actually buy it today, called In Search of the Common Good. And so what he's talking about is the decline of our society and the decline in the church and diagnosing some of those things around our loneliness. Like, it's just crazy how lonely we are as a society. We've never been more connected and yet more lonely at the same time. Rates of depression. We all know these issues that are coming up in our society. And he's arguing for the common good, that being that when we bring all these things together, when we live in a society surrounded by others and we share in good things with others, then we're better. It's an awesome argument. He argues from three different positions, talking about work, which is important for us, obviously, Sabbath, which is for us as well, and then home, and then showing how bringing those things together into community, thinking about them in different ways, improves our life in the spirit, our life with God, and our life with each other. And so I just think this is a really important book. I think it's one you should definitely check out. It is chock full of great theology. This conversation goes deep. I'm just going to tell you right now, I think this might be one to chew on for a little bit, but I think what we talk about is important stuff. I think this Sabbath thing, I got to tell you, I'm convicted about it right now, and you'll probably be hearing more from me, but I think this Sabbath thing is important for us as people who work, meaning all of us. All of us do some sort of work, and so we've lost the importance of rest. I mean, it's from the beginning, and so we talk about that. We talk about so much good stuff in this episode. I promise you, you're really going to enjoy it. Jake is a deep thinker, and he's thought through this stuff a lot. He has some really good stuff to bring to you, so I want to hear what you got out of this episode. Let me know. I'd love to hear. While you're thinking about it, if you could leave me a rating and review on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts, it helps get the word out. It helps people like Jake get their books out via the podcast. And so I would appreciate you going on and doing that. You can follow me on Instagram at Theology of Hustle, and you can watch me get better at Twitter at Curry Blanford on Twitter. I'm trying. I really am. So you can follow all those things. And yeah, I really hope you enjoy hearing from Jake. For real, I'd love to hear what you think, what you get out of this episode. Enjoy. All right. Well, Jake, thanks so much for jumping on the call with me. I really appreciate it. It's good to chat a little bit. So,
yeah, of course. Thanks for having me on.
All right. Well, let's jump off and just have you introduce yourself a little bit to everybody.
Sure. My name's Jake Meter. I'm the editor-in-chief of Mere Orthodoxy, which is a kind of classical conservative Christian journal online. And I'm also the vice president with a nonprofit called the Davenant Institute that equips lay people, pastors, young theologians with resources in Christian theology. It can be ethics, politics, doctrine of God. We've done lots of different things. We do conferences, publishing, kind of everywhere. So,
yeah.
I live in Lincoln, Nebraska, wife, three kids, and yeah, been here my whole life. Nebraska is my home. So,
I love it. Good stuff, man. Let's jump into it just a little bit of your story then. How did you, or I know that all stories have a tricky, you know, kind of history, but how did you sort of get where you are now?
So that's a very good question. The condensed version is that I grew up in a pretty dysfunctional church and broke, like left there when I was still in high school, actually, right in kind of the early, kind of the heyday of emergent church stuff and early days of Young Restless Reformed. So I was reading John Piper and Mark Driscoll and D.A. Carson at the same time that I was reading Brian McLaren and Rob Bell and Don Miller. And I was just super confused and also really angry, just had a lot of personal stuff I needed to work through. And in the middle of all of that, I read this article called The New Evangelical Scandal that ran in a journal called The City from Houston Baptist by a guy named Matthew Lee Anderson. And I read it and I liked it, I thought, but I had a lot of questions. And so I just decided I'm going to email the author and see what happens. And Matt wrote back to me, and that just became the start of a friendship. I was also involved with Presbyterian campus ministry at college and was getting plugged into kind of a Kellerite PCA church here in Lincoln. And so I was starting to kind of find my footing theologically. And I wrote for the campus newspaper. I've been writing since high school. I wrote for the high school paper when I was in school there. And so writing's just always been something I've done. And through that relationship with Matt, doors opened at Mir O. And then I've been editor in chief of Mir Orthodoxy since 2013. And so I've been running the site, and God's blessed the work. And a lot of people have been really generous to us. Rod Dreher was kind of singing our praises early on, and that kind of helped grow our profile a bit. And over the last several years, we've been able to do stuff with Tim Keller's been on our podcast a few times, Ross Douthat from the New York Times. And so the work's just kind of grown organically out of, I think, friendship and out of being blessed with a really good network of people that do good work. And so people are reading us and benefiting, which I'm grateful. So
I love that. That's good. Awesome. Well, so I have you on to talk about your book. Is this your first book?
Yes, it is.
Okay. So I have you on to talk about your book, In Search of the Common Good. Can you start off by just talking about the problem that you're trying to address in this book?
So there's been a lot of books in recent years about religious decline in the U.S. and Christian decline in particular. And I was reading all of those. And at the same time, I was reading books like George Packer's The Unwinding, Hillbilly Elegy by J.D. Vance is one a lot of people know. There's a book that actually just came out in the last year that I think is dealing with the same things as Vance, but in a better way, called Heartland by Sarah Smarsh, who's I'm probably partial because she's a lifelong Kansan. And so I feel an affinity with my fellow Great Plains Midwesterner. But I was reading all of these books at the same time that I was reading The Benedict Option and similar books by Anthony Esselin, Rusty Reno, Archbishop Chepu, and was kind of struck by the fact that there's this great concern about civil decline running parallel to a concern about religious decline. And so I started kind of thinking through that and ended up with this project where the two things I'm trying to do is, one, I'm trying to draw some connections between decline of the American church and decline of American civil society and explain what's behind that, which I would say is just a really bad story that most of us believe about the way common life works. Or doesn't work. And then the second part is trying to say, how can Christians be hopeful, positive witness, good neighbors in a society that's fragmenting? There's a crisis of loneliness facing us right now. There's crisis of family formation. We just aren't forming families. We aren't having kids. We don't have a lot of great third places where we can gather together. We have lots of mistrust. So there's all these problems. And as Christians, we believe in something that the original word meant good news, evangel. And so I want to be able to talk about the good news in a way that is actually recognizable as good news to our neighbors, which is something that we've struggled to do in recent years, I think. Yeah. So that's the goal, is try to define what exactly is going on, and then how can Christians respond fruitfully and helpfully so that our churches are flourishing, and also so that we're being good neighbors to the Christians that we're close to, but also to the non-Christians that are around us.
Yeah, it's good. Well, great summary. I mean, you wrote it, but it's like,
I've spent a lot of time with it.
I'm sure you have. I'm sure. Yeah. Can you talk about some of the philosophical underpinnings that like lead us to believe what we do? Your explanation of existentialism was as simple and understandable as I've ever heard.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah. I'm glad to hear that. Yeah. So the idea, actually, I have a good friend who just a couple weeks ago used the phrase, the leave me alone society, when we were talking. And I thought that's a really good kind of summary of it. So we have this idea, and some of us can explain it more clearly than others, but I think most of us in the West would share it to some degree, that I enter the world undefined on my own. And over the course of my life, through my choices, my actions, the practices I engage in, the things I tell myself about who I am and about the world, we kind of create our identity. And so there's lots of ways you could get there. And I work with several of them in the book. Jean-Paul Sartre, who's a French existentialist, mid-century, post-war France, he coins the phrase, existence precedes essence, which is probably the tightest way of describing it. And what he means by that is that you exist before you possess any kind of essential qualities or defining characteristics. You enter the world kind of naked and formless, and you define yourself over your life. A more recent articulation of it would come from Justice Kennedy, Anthony Kennedy, who retired last year from the Supreme Court. And what Justice Kennedy said, tellingly, in a case that was about abortion rights, he said that central to the idea of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of meaning, of existence, of life, and the universe. And so for Kennedy, and this is now written into legal precedent in the United States, if you don't have the right to define your own concept of meaning, of existence, of the universe, you are not free. Hmm. Which initially, like, we can hear that and kind of say, well, of course, who are you to impose your morality on me, or who are you to assign a role to me? We kind of intuitively, I think, we go with Kennedy. And yet, the way that that cashes out practically is pretty sad. David Brooks in the New York Times, he said, to define one's own concept of meaning is a very large homework assignment. And a lot of people aren't going to be up for it, not because of anything wrong with them, but because who is? But the other piece here is that there's something that's just on a very basic level not true about what Justice Kennedy wrote or about what Sartre was saying 75 years ago. I don't enter the world alone and without any identity. I'm carried for 9 months when I can't exist apart from the life of another. We are sustained through our early years, through the care of our parents or foster family or adopted parents or a friend. Like, it could be lots of people that sustain our lives in those early years, but no child is going to be able to take care of themselves. They need someone else. Even as adults, there was a Cigna study that came out in 2018 that said half of all Americans report daily feelings of loneliness. Hmm. And then a related study was just listing out all of the various health risks that coincide with loneliness. And you can even read studies. There was this really devastating piece. I think the New York Times, it was either the Times or the Post, had about this growing problem in Japan, where people who live by themselves are dying in their apartments, and then no one finds them for weeks or even months because they're isolated. They don't have people that they see regularly, and so they can disappear from life outside their home for months, and no one notices. So we don't have anything quite that extreme in mass in the U.S., thankfully, although we do have some similar stories, but it just doesn't actually work. We enter the world through community, and the good life is sustaining that close kinship and affection, friendship with people who sustain our lives. And we can't live well without that, even though our kind of founding, defining stories about identity and community in the West would say that we have to have this kind of right to self-define. It doesn't work that way in practice. It just makes us very lonely and anxious and depressed. So it doesn't work.
Yeah, it's powerful stuff. Okay, so, but all this supposed freedom, mm-hmm. like, leads us to a different sort of captivity, right? Yeah, just through like this bid for power. I loved how your book talked about this interplay between power and like society and our need to have power and influence. And
mm-hmm. yeah, so one of the things that's closely related to this right to self-define, and this is something that I think a lot of Christian conservatives haven't taken the time to understand. I was just listening to a podcast the other day from a fairly prominent magazine where they were talking about why do we get so worked up about politics and why is this such a big deal? When I was a kid, we could be friends with our political opposites. And it was this very kind of kids these days kind of.
Right. I love those.
Yeah. And I was just listening to it. I was like, you guys don't understand. We have this idea that I have the right to define my identity. And yet we have such deep divisions as to what identity should look like and how I should be able to do that, that a lot of political debates are extremely fraught because it's not just that we have a difference about, okay, well, we both agree we should care for the poor, and you think the marginal tax rate to generate the needed funds for a good safety net should be 70%. And I think that's crazy. And it should be 29% or something. That's not our political disputes, mostly. Sometimes it is, and that's helpful. But mostly it's not. It's very basic questions about what is a human being and what is the good life. And if a Christian conservative comes along talking about LGBT issues or abortion access, they often don't understand how central, again, it's significant that Kennedy's statement, that one I quoted before, it came in an abortion rights case. Hmm. That's where Kennedy is applying that idea. And so there's this very, like, these kind of political reforms that many progressives want are seen as being essential to their ability to self-define, which we've been told. I mean, I'm saying this, I'm 31. We've been told for most of our lives that that is central to the good life, is that you should be able to, you can be anything you want to be. You should be able to chase your dreams, to self-actualize, all of these different words we use. And now we're having these political debates about how we do that, but those debates are going to necessarily be really fraught because of how closely tied they are to identity. And so, yeah, everything ends up collapsing down into rival power claims because we don't actually have an idea of given identities that are good. We largely anymore don't have communities that sustain those ideas and make them plausible to people. And so, yeah, our politics necessarily become these very intense, kind of scary battles for people. Because if the other guy wins this election, from the perspective of a Christian business owner, say, if the other candidate wins, what's that going to mean for my business? From the perspective of a trans woman or a gay couple or some other member of the LGBT group, if a Christian wins and this law gets passed or this court justice gets appointed, what's that going to mean for my day-to-day life with my partner, with this kid that I want to adopt? The issue that the politics and identity are so closely connected that it makes politics very fraught and anxiety-inducing because there's not really a way of avoiding that, given right. the society we've created, which is horrible, but it's where we are. So,
yeah. Well, then let's talk a little bit about solutions. I Mm-hmm. Yeah. The common good. I mean, I know that's a big topic, but how do you sort of talk through the need for community and desire for all that?
Yeah. So the way I argue in the book is there's three parts of life that I'm working from Christian assumptions. So I'm working from creation, fall, redemption, kind of classic Reformed story of scripture. There's three parts of human life before sin enters the world that are just normal. They're kind of hardwired into us and into creation. The first is work. They're put in a garden. They're put in a garden to steward it, not to exploit it, not to dominate it. Their health and the garden's health are together. They're not identical, but they're closely interwoven. So work. And then the second is marriage. And in the book, I kind of expand on that a little bit because we often think of marriage as these are two people who have strong feelings for each other, who have a sexual relationship, and we are going to create a publicly recognized contract to afford them certain rights. And that's marriage. A Christian understanding of marriage is that it's a covenant where the two become one. They are committed to each other for life, and their lives are bound together in such a way that it can't be sundered. What God has joined together, let no man take apart. And so that then necessarily, I mean, one condition of marriage is it's going to lead to children. So children are now implicated in this story in Genesis 2. Presumably, if Adam and Eve had continued in the garden without sin, there'd be more families, there'd be neighbors, there'd be people who share work together, and they're all doing it within this, also within this sense of context where they're connected to the garden. So I talk about membership in that chapter, working from Wendell Berry. And I mean, the thing that's funny is that if you read Tolkien or Lewis, both of them, these ideas are everywhere in their work. And a lot of people just don't pick up on it, but it's there. And then the third thing that's normal before the fall is Sabbath. And so that means a break from work. And what Sabbath, I think, can do is there's a great quote from a Jewish rabbi named Abraham Heschel, who has a wonderful book on the Sabbath that I recommend to people. And Heschel talks about in the book how much of our lives are ordered to the world of space. So it's physical places, it's physical things we hold with our hands as we do our work. It's rooms that we're sitting in and eating in, thinking about something, talking to people. And that's fine. That's not wrong. We live our lives in the world of space. That makes sense. But we don't belong exclusively to the world of space. We also belong to, Heschel calls it, the world of time. And when we remind ourselves of the world of time, we're being reminded that you are mortal, you will die. Memento mori is the Latin. We're being reminded that there are ends that we aspire to that are transcend like money or houses or physical possessions. So it orders us to another kind of value system, another world, and it should condition how we participate in this one. So it informs how you approach membership, how you approach work. It also, there's Jamie Smith wrote Desiring the Kingdom, You Are What You Love, amongst many other books. He talks about our daily habits and practices as liturgies. And both he and Dreher are concerned about how the kind of daily liturgies of our culture shape us in ways that are hostile to Christian spiritual formation. And I think one of the things that Sabbath can do is it's shaping us in an alternative world. Alternative is probably not even the right word, but it's helping us remember you need rest because God rested, and you rest because you trust that God will provide. In the book, I talk about how Sabbath is a test of faith for the Israelites. They have to do certain things that they would not otherwise do because of the Sabbath. So they gather extra manna on the sixth day and during their wilderness wanderings. They don't plant during Sabbath years, or they're not supposed to. I mean, one thing that sometimes gets lost in the biblical text is they're exiled for 70 years, and those 70 years are meant to give the land 70 years of Sabbath rest, because Israel had not been practicing the Sabbath year, where every seventh year they didn't plant. But doing that is a test of faith. Do you trust that God's going to provide for you for that right. year and for the start of the next year when you don't have reserves from the previous harvest? So we don't have anything quite like that just because our economy has changed and our farming has changed. But it's a recognition that you are called to trust God with your life, with your affairs. And if we're following the norms of creation described in Genesis, this is something we're doing one day in seven. And so that it's this constant part of our life to be reminded that you will die, that you are made for God, that God will provide. And in a culture that is really struggling with anxiety right now, in particular, there's a story the Post did about anxiety on college campuses with rising generations. So Generation Z or iGen. It's just off the charts relative to previous. I mean, even millennials, it's far higher, far worse than what we have. So in this society that's really lonely and really anxious, I think Sabbath can be a really powerful witness. And it can be I would even say an evangelistic tool. You can invite other people into your Sabbath practice. There's a family I mentioned in the acknowledgments, the Rolands, that are, he's a pastor in rural Iowa, and they have a wonderful Sabbath practice, and they have people in their home every week. So we would have 20 people around the lunch table after church, and then some of them would go, they live in a town with a big lake, so they'd go out to the lake for a little bit, and other people would stay home and take a nap or sit in the living room and talk. And it just made Sabbath real for me, I think, in a way I hadn't understood before, by sharing that with other people. So it can be a really good way, I think, of drawing other people in and giving them a chance to see what Christian community can be.
Yeah. It's mind-boggling to me. So I've been recently convicted of the Sabbath. I really enjoyed your treatment of it. I've read Heschel's book like three or four times, just never actually put anything into practice, right?
That's hard.
I've been recently convicted over the last like 2 months of like actually doing a Sabbath. And you look at it, I mean, God finishes creation on the seventh day by Sabbathing, right? It's written into the Ten Commandments, which we evangelicals love to hold up as these like should right. be everywhere, right? Right? Mm. It goes throughout the entirety of Scripture, right? Like you said, Israel is kicked out of the land for not, you know, observing the Sabbath year. But how in the world did we lose the importance of the Sabbath so egregiously?
I think there's probably a couple things, and I don't know how much to weigh them. I think probably the bigger thing is because we self-define, one of the main areas in which we self-define by necessity is going to be in our jobs. We're going to spend more time with the people we work with, probably than anyone else we see during the week. We'll spend more time on that work than we will any other kind of work we do. When you factor in commuting times and all of these things, there's a lot of people, they're called extreme commuters in the Northeast, like in big expensive cities where they have such long commutes that they just don't see their families during the week. So work becomes this very all-consuming thing because we have this itch to like answer, who am I? And we think we do that through our work, through our career, really. And so that just drives a lot of commercial activity. It drives a lot of choices that we make, and it doesn't leave a lot of room for Sabbath, particularly with younger people who often have a lot of undergrad debt that they have to pay off and who often work in these tech companies that can kind of behave like religious cults. When you look at the way they market themselves, they kind of want to be the be-all and all community for their employees, which is really scary. And so all of that doesn't leave a lot of time for Sabbath, because Sabbath is not terribly efficient. It's not a good way to communicate to some supervisors and employers that you care about your work when you just become unavailable completely right. for a day. Although theoretically we should have weekends in a lot of cases, but workaholism is a thing and it's a thing encouraged by a lot of companies. But I also think for Christians, yeah, it's written into the Ten Commandments, but I think a lot of American Christians struggle to know what to do with the Old Testament right. and how Old Testament idea, like laws and norms apply to us today. And to some extent, that's understandable because some of the questions genuinely are difficult. But the move that the reformers, the early reformers make, is they actually say that the Ten Commandments are just a really tight distillation of what they call the natural law, the law that God kind of impresses on our consciences and that is hardwired into creation. And I think with Sabbath, that's very clear because it really is right there in the creation account.
Right.
And so if we're going back to our sources as evangelicals, this isn't a hard problem. But if we're working from more 20th century frameworks, we often don't know what to do with the Old Testament. And there isn't a clear honor the Sabbath day and keep it holy command in the New Testament. Right. And so a lot of people will look at that and say, well, maybe we don't need a Sabbath in the New Testament or in the church because it's not there in the New Testament. And that's really bad hermeneutics and we shouldn't do that. But I think that is how a lot of people get there. And so our jobs incentivize us to not rest. And then we don't have good theological resources for prioritizing the Sabbath.
Yeah. Well put.
Thanks.
Yeah. I think that's important stuff, especially on this podcast, right? Like we talk about the hustle and I think there's great, I mean, people do great work that God has us putting our hands to amazing work. But if we're not going to trust him with that work and we're not going to, you know, Sabbath and remind ourselves that it's God's work and not necessarily ours, you know, then I think we get pretty twisted, you know, pretty quick.
Yeah. Well, and there's a confusion that a lot of us have, again, going back to the way that careers and professions work in the U.S. and the lack of community, that work, which scripture clearly says is good,
right,
is synonymous with what you do that is compensated by a business owner or by the marketplace. And a lot of times, fair, yeah, that's true. But also, there are things you can do that are compensated by the marketplace that are bad, and that if you can avoid it, you shouldn't do them. My friend Charlie Clark wrote a piece for Mere Orthodoxy where he was kind of poking the Protestant doctrine of vocation a little bit. So he said, okay, we say that God milks the cow through the milkmaid fulfilling her vocation. Does God sell the fraudulent ISDA loan through the bad mortgage banker? And hopefully we answer no, because that's bad and you shouldn't do that. But right. That's the kind of confusion we can get into on one side where we just think my work has to be recognized through the marketplace. The other side is there's lots of good and necessary work in our local communities that, and it's not necessarily wrong that it isn't compensated by the marketplace, but it's not compensated by the marketplace. So we have a family here in town that go to a sister congregation of ours, where one of the wife earns enough money in her job that the husband doesn't need a job that pays him a salary. And yet the takeaway from this is not, oh, this is great, this means that I can just pursue all of my little kind of selfish hobbies all day. What he does with that is he says, well, I'm now freed up to identify ways that I can be a blessing to my neighborhood and my city that won't necessarily pull a paycheck, but I don't need a paycheck, so I can just do it. So he runs a food distribution ministry for low-income Lincolnites. He refs in youth sports. And so he's involved in these. He serves in several different neighborhood organizations. And so he's able to be involved in lots of different things. He's super involved in his church because he can see there's lots of good work I can do,
And we're in a place where we've been blessed that I don't need to have a paying job. So I'm going to pursue those works and be a great neighbor and a great blessing to my city in very tangible ways. And I think he's absolutely fulfilling the Christian vision of work, even if it's not necessarily a market-friendly vision of work in some ways.
Yeah, totally. That's good. Can you speak to sort of the new creation, like the, you know, I appreciated your treatment of Revelation 21 and the new heavens and new earth, right? And I know that discussion's very in-depth, but can you give us just a little bit of some of that vision?
There was a little bit of exercising personal demons in approaching that chapter. Because I grew up, I remember hearing people at church, thankfully never my parents. My dad is actually a great conservationist, but I would hear people at church, like, if, well, climate change came up growing up, or this was the 90s, so it was more hole in the ozone layer, things like that. Say, well, the world's gonna burn anyway, so what does it matter? Which, A, like, even if that's true, you're still called to be a steward.
Right.
Your children will die someday, but you still recognize that the way you treat them matters. There's lots of things that won't endure forever that we still think that doesn't entitle you to abuse it. That just, you still have responsibilities. But then the other thing is, there's a great book called Creation Regained by a Dutch Reformed theologian named Al Wolters, who taught at Redeemer College in Hamilton, Ontario for quite a while. And Wolters argues in the book, I think persuasively, that it's actually not appropriate or biblical to say that this creation is going to be obliterated and some new world is going to come into being at the end of all things. Because the proof text that everybody goes to for that is in 2 Peter 3, where it talks about the present elements being consumed by fire. But what's interesting there is there's two things there. So the first thing is that in that text, the comparison Peter uses for what is coming is the flood. And the flood didn't obliterate the world. It purified it, as judgment often does in Scripture. But then the second thing is, Wolters actually argues that a lot of translations we have are not good. And the Greek there would be better rendered, will be laid bare. And something laid bare is not obliterated. It's, again, cleansed, purified, renewed. And even the Greek in Revelation 21, when it talks about a new heaven and a new earth, the Greek word there that is used is kainos, which means renewed. If they meant it didn't exist before and now it does exist, the new heavens and the new earth, you would expect it to use the word neos, because Greek has different words that it can use for new, that we translate new, but they're different words. Right. And so new would be the word that you would use for, like, a new baby. Or in Acts 5, when Ananias and Sapphira are killed, it talks about the young men who take them away. The young there is the word neos. But that's not the word that's used in Revelation. It's renewed. And then what's really beautiful when you actually dig into that text in Revelation, it talks about the nations of the earth bringing their glory into the New Jerusalem, which I think is this idea of we in some sense, our work endures and we bring it into the New Jerusalem and we lay it before Christ's feet as an act of worship. I mean, kind of, I'm reminded of the parables where Christ will talk about the different servants who are given different amounts of money, and the ones that are righteous come and lay what they've produced at the king's feet with what he gave them. I think that's what's in view in Revelation. And so it suggests that the world that we're in today endures into eternity, and it's transformed at the return of Christ because it's no longer groaning under sin, as Paul says in Romans 8. But the idea is not that there's, like, at the end of the world, God destroys everything and then makes two new things, new heavens, new earth. That's not in the text. Right. And yet that's what a lot of Christians think. And that attitude kind of then works backwards into how we think about the world as we encounter it today, the way we think it, the way we can think about our work sometimes. Like I had one friend talk about one time, Catholic friend, say that you shouldn't do any more work than you have to provide a minimal standard of living for you and your family so that you can have as much time as possible to pray. And it's just like, well, I don't want to demean, like, obviously we need to pray. We need to have rich spiritual disciplines. But that just struck me as a very difficult idea to square with what scripture says about the goodness of work and with the work that God gives Adam and Eve to do. Genesis, like, part of the way that we're made in God's image is we are made as creators like God. And we aren't like God because we can't create ex nihilo out of nothing, but we still create. We use our rationality and our bodies, and we make things that didn't exist in that way before. And that in that way, we honor God by imitating him in a certain sense. And so I think when you have that piece, and then you also understand what's really going on in Revelation, it gives you a really... I hope great appreciation for what exactly we're called to do in the world and the high calling that we have.
Yeah. I was saying in a lot of ways, we're working towards actually working in new creation, you know, like freed from sin, you know, and to really put our hands to good work, you know, without that. So
yeah,
I think that's important. If we all had that view of work and we really looked to that, I think it would change the way we go about everything. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's good stuff. Okay. So we have Sabbath, work, and then home, which you've addressed to some extent with marriage. Can you talk just a little bit about just the ordering of life and even singleness and marriage? And I really appreciated your treatment of that as well.
Yeah. I was, a friend of mine reminded me of a passage from Oliver O'Donovan that I used in the book where O'Donovan argues that the two vocations that Christians can be called to are celibacy or marriage. And in marriage, we're being reminded of creation and the natural goodness of the created order. And we're seeing ourselves participate in that in a very obvious way in the bearing of children. That's the most literal, obvious way in which a marriage is fruitful. It's not the only way, but it's the most clear. And it's a way in which your life is really knit into the life of the world in a profound way. But then O'Donovan also says that the celibate reminds us of what we're ultimately made for. We're made to know God and to find our delight in him, to love him. And that calling is so great. Now, hopefully, and in a just, healthy society, there shouldn't be a contest between my affection for family, for friends, for my home place, and my commitment to God. But we do live in a sinful world, and there are times where those do come into conflict. Mm-hmm. And so great is God's command of us. He's our creator, that in those situations we say with Christ, who is my father, who is my mother? And so there's a sense in which the claims of family and the claims of place and all of these things are kind of relativized in a particular way by the claims of God on our life and by the joy that can be found in knowing God. And so the celibate reminds us of that we do not need we don't need to be married to have a fulfilling life as a human being made in God's image, living in God's world. We don't need to have sex for that. We don't need to have children in that way. There's a real sense in which to be celibate is to order yourself to God in this very real and profound way. And I think that gets lost a lot of times in how we talk about family, how we talk about marriage, such that you think your life is a failure or something if you don't get married. And if you have a calling to marriage, then you should try to get married. But what the witness of singles in the church can remind us of is the goodness of God, the satisfaction of knowing God, and ultimately the need that if you have God, like there's the, I don't remember the exact phrase, and there's ways I'd quibble with it because I think it can lead to confusion, but Jesus plus nothing equals everything is the phrase I've heard people use. And that can demean the good relationships God gives us that he calls us to enjoy. And that are ways for us to honor him. But there is also a real sense in which you need Christ more than anything else. And if you have everything else and you don't have Christ, then like if you gain the whole world but lose your soul, what does it profit you? And so I think the witness of celibates in the church can be a very profound reminder in a similar way to the Sabbath of our end as human beings and our ultimate need as human beings to know God. And both of those things are held together in the church in a really beautiful way, I think. So you don't want to get into something where you're privileging one over the other. They're both licit vocations. They both have a place in the life of God's people and in the life of our cities. But they do remind us of different things and call our attention to different things.
Yeah, that's good. I appreciate that. One aspect of this too is like, I guess I might be putting words in your mouth, but does all this like pushes us towards the community of God, right? Because in your vision of the common good, it's at the base sort of community. Is that true?
Yeah. So common good is a phrase that gets thrown around a lot, and I'm now party to that, I suppose.
At least you know.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Right. And it doesn't always get defined well. So there can be this idea that common good is just this kind of general spirit of benevolence that we have to all people, or that it's this thing where we want to just maximize people's access to certain things. And if we've done that, we pat ourselves in the back and we've fulfilled the common good. And that's not actually how Christians have traditionally used the phrase. We should aspire to have a society where people's needs are met, certainly. But the idea of a common good is it's a good that can only be enjoyed as it's intended to be enjoyed when it's held in common with other people. So a friend of mine, Jose Mena, a really smart young Catholic writer, he says a lot of us have this idea that the common good is like a pizza. And if the pizza is big enough that everybody gets a slice, we have fulfilled the common good. The problem with that is I can take my slice of the pizza and then go sit by myself in my room, and my experience of the pizza will not be any different, like at least of the pizza itself, than it would be if I was sitting at the dining room table with a few other people. The thing itself doesn't change based on whether I'm having it by myself or with others. The idea of a common good is something more like a symphony, where if the first trumpet in the orchestra decides to go off and play his part of Bach or Mozart or whoever on his own, it's not the same thing as if the full symphony plays it. You need the full symphony to really experience that piece the way it's intended to be. And so common goods are things that we share together that can't actually be shared exclusively alone. And so I think ultimately, like, we are like the thing that we should all share and enjoy together is God. He's who we are made to know. He is who created us. And so that would be the like ultimate common good. But then there's kind of subservient common goods that we can share. Neighborliness. My experience of my neighborhood will be very different if I lock myself in my house every day and don't know anyone versus if I make a point of sitting outside and saying hi to my neighbor, knowing enough about what's going on in their life to bring them flowers when something sad happens, or to go knock on their door and ask to borrow some sugar if I'm baking something, and then maybe I share what I bake with them. And yet, again, this is the way that America makes this very hard. You think about the way that life in a lot of places work. We have attached garages. And so you can
go through an entire day very easily without ever actually like stepping outside into your front yard. Because you go through the door into your car, you open the garage door with your automatic opener, you back out, go to work, you come home, open the garage without ever getting out of your car, pull in, get out of your car and go inside. And you're never even outside to see anyone.
Right.
And so you don't actually have that shared common life of a neighborhood because you don't even know who your neighbors are. And to some extent, this part of what makes this so perverse is that even if you as an individual want that, but your neighbors don't, you're still not going to realize it. So it's a really complicated, knotty problem. But those are the kind of things I have in view when I'm thinking about a common good. It's something that you can't actually enjoy it properly by yourself. You need to be with other people to really experience whatever that good is.
Yeah, that's good. No, I appreciate that. I think that's important for all of us because it is our societies are made for us to be individuals and just put our head down and work. And yeah.
Yep. Right. I mean, I lived in Minnesota for a short time after college, and I learned in Minnesota, because winters are so brutal, they often will have underground parking at offices. And so people can go through an entire day without even being outside in the winter. Right. And I have friends who live up there and they're like, don't knock it until you've spent enough winters up here because they're bad, I get. But on the other hand, it strikes me as just a very sad thing how easy we make it to isolate ourselves.
Yeah, totally. That's good stuff. All right. Well, can we jump into the final two questions to close this out?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So my first question is, what is the strangest job that you have ever had?
See, I've spent time trying to think about this and I've had trouble landing at an answer. So probably I graduated from college in 2010, which was a terrible time to graduate college, particularly with an English degree, English and history. Oh, nice. And so I was scrambling for jobs. And so I got a freelance job with a company called Patch.com. It's owned by AOL. And they were trying to build these kind of like hyper local newspapers online. And their strategy here was that we're going to build the best online business directory you can possibly get. And that will be how we generate traffic, which will then build an audience for these hyper local newspapers. So they hired contractors to go out and take pictures of local businesses and build a listing of the business. The problem is none of these businesses had any idea who we were. They had never heard of Patch.com. So they didn't want some random person walking into the business with a camera. And if they saw a random person outside taking pictures, they got nervous. So it was just a weird job where, I mean, kind of sales adjacent, where you just spend most of your day being told no, I suppose. But in a very weird kind of way where you're trying, like, in our minds, we're trying to create something to help you, but you don't understand that and you have no idea who you are. And so this is just really weird. And then the weirdest thing that happened is I was supposed to build listings for banks. And I just wasn't taking pictures of banks because I was like, if I'm standing outside taking a picture of a bank,
right,
that's not going to end well for me. And then I had a listing for a bank get rejected because it didn't have photos. And so I was like, so you want me to stand outside of a bank and take pictures in broad daylight and this is going to be okay? And my supervisor wrote back, well, we normally tell people that they should stand across the street so no one sees them.
Oh my God.
I don't think that's any better.
Right. Maybe worse. Who knows? Yeah, I don't know.
A bit creepier, actually. Yeah. So yeah, that was probably, I have to think more, but that was one that came to mind with that question.
I'd say that qualifies for sure.
It paid for my wife's engagement ring, so I can't complain about the job too much. It didn't That's pay all. For a lot else, but it paid for the engagement ring.
I love it. Okay, so my final question then is, what is one piece of advice you would give to somebody looking to bring God's kingdom more into their work?
Mm-hmm. That's a big question, and it's a really hard one.
So we'll start by assuming that this is actually good work.
Sure.
And not work that the person should be looking to get out of because it's hurting themselves or their local community. But if it, assuming it's good work, I think it is a good thing to recognize the ways in which we can serve people in our jobs. It can be very simple ways. I think about there's a training video that my boss at my day job will sometimes show people. I think it was Chick-fil-A did it. So it shows people walking into the store and people sitting and the camera's panning over them. And then it will have a line of text underneath. Just graduated. Son is in Iraq. Their spouse of 47 years just died. And so what the video is trying to say is it's the C.S. Lewis line. You've never encountered a mere mortal. It's helping you see that this person who's standing at this register just experienced something horrible. And now they're here because they need to eat. Or that person sitting at the table who you're about to go serve is really, really excited because something good happened. Or this person is experiencing something really hard. Our jobs can encourage us to kind of slice our life up into artificial portions and think that those things don't matter. And yet that's not how we live as human beings. So I think trying to remember the fact that you aren't working with a professional or whatever their job title is, you're working with a human being.
Right.
You're serving human beings in your job. So it just hopefully reframes the way that you approach people. And it's something I need to remember myself as well, because it can be hard to do that because jobs can be stressful and there's lots of anxiety that can come with them. But at bottom, you're still working with human beings that are full, like made in the image of God, with desires and pains and sorrows. And you're encountering them in the midst of all that, and you can encounter them in a way that, even in a small way, that can be really trivial. So my wife and I, we have three kids, and that's not a huge family, but particularly if you're a woman and you're out in public with our oldest is six. So like, right. You're out in public with a bunch of little tiny kids. There can be judgment. There can be mean, there can be rude words. And there was a guy at our house a month ago to bury a utility line. And I think he was probably, we have a lot of Iraqi refugees and immigrants in Lincoln. I'm guessing he was Iraqi, but he saw our kids out there playing and he just got this huge grin. And he said, "I love big families." And he didn't have a lot of English, so he couldn't say a lot more, but he just kept saying that to us and shook our hands and was just very obviously delighting in our kids. And it was funny that little thing just kind of stayed with me throughout the day. Like, somebody thinks this is good that we have a lot of young kids. And so I think even little, like, seemingly trivial things like that can be ways of communicating care and value to people.
Yeah, that's good. I really appreciate that. That's something I need to remember myself, and it's deeply convicting to me. So yeah, good stuff, man.
Can be to me too.
Totally.
Yeah.
It's good. Well, thanks for making time for me. I'm excited to,
thanks.
For
sure. This has been fun.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I can't wait to see the book get out in the world, and it's good stuff. So.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks. Talk soon. Bye. Well, I hope you enjoyed hearing from Jake. I, again, want to reiterate that I think this is an important discussion. I think these are important things that we need to be thinking about. And I love that Theology of Hustle is a place where we can talk about these things, where it's a community. I'd love to hear your thoughts on what you got out of this. Like, where do we go from here? Even maybe are some books that help you think along these lines, think along the common good and think along, you know, work, Sabbath, and home, and the ordering of our lives around something besides just running like crazy, like trying to survive. Like, I feel like I live a lot of the time. So yeah, how do we think about this stuff? Where do we go from here? Let's keep the conversation rolling, y'all. I love it. You can do that on all the socials. You can always hit me up via email on my website. Love to hear from you. And until next time,
get out there and hustle.